This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll discover how some college professors are having to do some learning of their own to educate students remotely. We'll find out what some nursing homes are doing to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The fight against the coronavirus has forced restaurants to only offer pickup and some delivery services. Restaurant owners are doing their best to hang on.
We're going to have to come back slowly and surely because you never know what's going to happen around the corner. So we're really going to have to get our feet back off the ice before I start to take any risks or try to grow my business.
For some who've lost their jobs, desperation can lead them to sex work. We'll hear more about that. And what are the challenges facing rural hospitals? Those stories and more on this episode of Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, manufacturing in Illinois is shifting gears to help during the pandemic. We'll hear about that. Also, more on the problems facing rural hospitals as they get ready for the coronavirus. And we'll hear from a COVID-19 patient in his own words. That and more coming up. Faith groups and campus ministries are adapting during the COVID-19 pandemic. Peter Medlin tells us more on how they're trying to keep their communities connected, even when they can't worship together in person.
The sound of Christian hymns echoes through an empty sanctuary during a Facebook Live service at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in DeKalb. Like non-essential businesses, the church's doors have been locked to their congregations in the interest of public health. You can imagine parishioners are singing along, sheltered in place at their homes. Marty Marks is the pastor at Emmanuel. One of his members wanted to sing, but didn't have a hymnal.
I did kind of a drive-by ding-dong ditch thing where I went to the house, I rang the doorbell, you know, I'm leaving the hymnal here.
Every faith group is trying new ways to keep their communities connected, even if they can't do it face-to-face. For many, Facebook has been the tool of choice to reach them. Facebook Live sermon broadcasts and Zoom prayer meetings are the new norm. They're also keeping up with each other through phone calls, emails, and WhatsApp. For the Muslim Association of Greater Rockford, it's been a big adjustment. Just consider their mosque's normal Friday prayer gatherings.
We usually have approximately 700 people. Now, there is none.
That is Imam Muhammad Ahmed Al-Ghabashi of the Muslim Association of Greater Rockford. The association posted daily prayer from home instructions on its website.
You can pray anywhere, and if you have some emergency time like this, you will get the same reward from God if you prayed home, you didn't come to the mosque.
Denzel Lukritz is the pastor at Trinity Episcopal Church in Aurora. He's been having morning and evening prayer groups on Zoom. He's also doing Facebook streams for the first time.
Everybody's been talking about a learning curve. It has not been a learning curve at all. It has been like a rocket launch. It has been straight up.
Many people's daily schedules have all but exploded during the COVID-19 crisis. Reverend Eric Doolittle says having a prayer schedule, like in Islam, can be beneficial to anyone in any faith tradition.
Finding that time, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 20 if you can do it, to be intentional about the different parts of your self-care is essential.
Reverend Doolittle is the chaplain at North Central College's Office of Faith and Action. He says he's eager to see how people of faith take the opportunity for action in their communities.
How will people use the extra time and as they feel that they are able to engage, to give back, to embody the love of neighbor in a proactive way?
Members of the Muslim Association of Greater Rockford are helping deliver meals to students. Other religious groups at Northern Illinois University are working with food insecurity missions for college students and trying to connect them to other campus resources. Marty Marks is also the president of ACRO, the Association of Campus Religious Organizations at NIU. He says those student faith groups are also staying plugged in with each other.
I don't see me doing a Snapchat or TikTok Bible study, but yeah, you never know.
Reverend Doolittle at North Central College is hoping church leaders learn to rely on the young adults they have.
They're already experts, so lean into them.
One of the religious organizations at North Central, the Christian Fellowship Focus, is breaking services into chunks through the week and curating Spotify playlists for worship. But despite the innovation, many churches are also feeling a financial burden.
It's all unknown.
Marty Marks of Emmanuel Lutheran explains.
We have no idea what our offerings over the next few weeks are going to look like. We're in the process of budgeting for our next fiscal year. So, you know, we have no clue what our income's going to look like.
Some churches, like Emmanuel, also run schools that have teachers and staff who need to be paid. Most churches are setting up online giving options in the meantime. For now, Denzel Lukritz at Trinity Episcopal says he's seeing his community step up spiritually for each other.
All of that has been challenging. At the same time, there's been a silver lining because we're coming together in ways that are simply remarkable.
And with coronavirus stress and anxiety taking a toll on many, faith groups pray they can continue to nurture spiritual care for themselves and others in a uniquely uncertain time. I'm Peter Medlin.
Now the story of a Chicago-area man who has tested positive for COVID-19. Michael Bain is using an oxygen tank to breathe while being treated for bilateral pneumonia at Rush University Medical Center. Bain spent some of his time in the hospital writing an essay about his experience with the illness, from when he was first exposed to his positive test results. And he shared those words from his hospital room.
Short version? It's brutal. I have no doubt it can kill you. I'm 42 years old, and I'm relatively healthy. On March 3, I went to a routine doctor's appointment at the hospital where my wife works. I thought it would be nice to surprise her with flowers. On my way, I had a brief encounter with someone who would later test positive for COVID-19. I didn't see my wife, but I leave the flowers in her office. Fast forward to March 14th. I have a sore throat and slight cough. I see a post that says if you can hold a deep breath for 10 seconds without coughing, it's a good sign. I can. The next day, the symptoms are worse. I can't sleep, and I have a slight fever. I call Rush's 24-hour corona hotline, and I'm told to schedule a video appointment tomorrow. Monday, March 16th. The video check costs $49 up front. After a two-hour wait, I'm face-to-virtual-face with a physician's assistant. She says I should get tested, and I'll have an in-person appointment within 5 days. I'm trying to work from home here and there, but the constant pain is wearing on me. My fever continues to worsen. An Arctic blast hits my body. My skin is on fire. This doesn't feel right at all. My wife insists that I get in a room temperature bath. I try to get in, but it feels like ice. Clearly, my wife and the virus are working together to kill me. And I soak for 30 minutes and feel a lot better. Not even sure if I need this test. I need this test. Tuesday, March 17th. The fever is back and the cough is worse. I don a mask and drop my daughter off at daycare. I have 30 minutes to make my testing appointment. There's traffic on 290. How is this happening? Isn't everybody staying at home due to the national emergency? Turns out the gate of a truck popped open, and hundreds of cases of liquor have spilled out. The earth itself has to be drunk from this one. I call the testing site and tell them a truck has spilled booze everywhere, so I'm running a couple of minutes late. They confirm what kind of car I'm driving, what I'm wearing, and tell me to pull into a reserved spot. I arrive and do as I've been instructed. A hospital employee steps out in a mask and motions for me to get out of the car. He immediately instructs me to put my hands in my pocket and not to remove them, and I follow him inside. The doctor at the end of the hall is dressed like she's about to enter Chernobyl. She asks me how I'm doing. I try to think of a clever response, but whatever I mumble is largely ignored as the doctor muses to herself, maybe she should stop asking that question. She explains the nasal swab process and says the probe is going to go in real deep. She puts my sample in a vial and opens the door while instructing me to put my hands in my pockets. She yells, "Clear," down the hallway, and a few seconds pass before an affirmative, "Clear," is shouted back. I exit and go home to wait for her test results. Wednesday, March 18th. It's been 2 weeks since I was exposed. My wife asked me if I can keep an eye on my daughter when she goes downstairs. I watch her as best I can through open doors across a hallway. My wife comes back and I close the door. I cry, alone in my room for a while. I haven't been able to interact with my daughter in 4 days. Thursday, March 19th. I don't know how much fight is left in me. I think about all the people in Italy who may have died alone this way and begin to sob uncontrollably. To everyone who said this was just a bad cold, f*** you. Friday, March 20th. I get into a few arguments with people on social media regarding the term Chinese virus My opinion as an Asian American is quickly and skillfully invalidated with well-crafted lines of reasoning such as, just another snowflake. Saturday, March 21st. Breathing is getting harder. I don't exactly feel near death, but more like life adjacent. My wife finally convinces me to go to the ER. Triage is weird. I'm told to sit in a chair in a barren cement room. My phone rings. The health professional on the other end tells me I'm positive for COVID-19. I text my family, a few close friends, and my boss. My boss lets me know they're going to have to inform the office someone tested positive, but they'll keep me anonymous. I tell them to use my name. It's a scary message to get. If people have questions, maybe I can help. So here I am, in the hospital, on the 13th floor, with a lovely view of the city. Take that, isolation. The point of all this? This is horrible, brutal, devastating, and it feels like I might be cashing my chips in. People have died. People will die. Might be someone you love. Please take this seriously. Protect the people you care about as best you can.
This essay was written by Berwyn resident Michael Bain. It was produced by WBEZ's Mariah Wolfel, with production assistance from Stephen Jackson.
You're listening to Statewide. There's a new fundraising effort to help Illinois artists and artisans. The Arts Illinois Relief Fund allows for donations that will be turned into grants to help during a time when nearly all performances and exhibits have been canceled. Chicago artist Amanda Williams says the arts community is resilient.
We will not stop making, creating, inspiring, challenging, bearing witness, and bringing hope. In fact, that's all we know to do in these moments.
Williams says while some performers have continued to share art online, the shutdown has been far-reaching, and she says those who do lighting, costumes, and more have also found themselves out of work. More details about the relief fund can be seen at artsforillinois.org. Reminder, you can find all of our episodes. They're available at statewideshow.com and see which of your favorite stations air the show and when. That's at statewideshow.com. Most colleges have transitioned to an online-only format in order to comply with the state's efforts to combat the new coronavirus. The transition has not been a completely smooth one. Mike Smith talked to a few professors at the University of Illinois Springfield to understand how they're adapting their lesson plans for a world on lockdown.
Let's take a look at a couple of professors who, by the very nature of what they teach, have run headlong into plenty of online obstacles. Shane Harris is an associate professor of ceramics at UIS. He says teaching his ceramics course remotely is something he was a little apprehensive about.
I've been asked multiple times to teach online, but the reality is it's a hands-on course. You learn by making and doing and interacting. And so virtually, it's a lot more challenging to do that in my field.
To keep it hands-on, Harris has had to figure out how to send physical art supplies to his students. His director told him to use department funds to pay for it.
So I ended up with my student workers, called every single one of my students and asked them, are you going to be back on campus? Can you come pick up the clay? If not, then I am going to ship it to you.
Harris says he's not tech savvy and admitted he never used the teaching website Blackboard before last week, but he says his students are helping him learn the ropes. Those who are training the next generation of medical workers are also facing difficulties. More healthcare professionals are needed now more than ever, but a lot of classes in the field involve hands-on experiences. Amanda Lee Adams is an assistant professor in the Department of Allied Health, the Medical Laboratory Science Program at UIS. She says she's providing students those hands-on experiences by
going out and looking at videos and critiquing those videos so that the students can watch them and can develop some skill sets that we can work with over the summer.
Adam says, like any healthcare worker, she adapted and overcame online teaching challenges by tackling them head on, despite not being comfortable with certain things. She says university's Information Technology Services and COLORS, the Center for Online Learning Research and Service, provided instructors resources to help make remote teaching a possibility.
They sent us a virtual link for a couple of labs that the students could actually practice some of those skill sets online, and so I've passed those on to the students. But if we're forced to do this for much longer, I'll have to get a little bit more creative for sure.
COLORS Director Vicki Cook says her department anticipated teachers quickly having to convert classes into a different medium.
Having that collapsed time to take what normally they would have several weeks to prepare, and in the middle of the semester try to change tracks for modality is very difficult.
Cook says the center has been helping teachers with the transition by introducing faculty to a bunch of different online teaching methods.
And they're doing that primarily through readings, interactive activities online that they've pulled together, videos that they have done or pulled together from other faculty in those same disciplines that have allowed their videos to be used.
There are also several faculty members across the country who are sharing their own lab experiences to try and help teachers build a content base that can be shared with other schools. Brian Chen is an assistant professor of public health at UIS. He attended the two workshops COLORS set up for faculty members to help prepare teachers for the transition. He says he learned how to connect to a VPN from his home when conducting class.
The faculty or instructors need to work from home. They need to connect their office computers. Then this is the knowledge they need to learn.
He says instructors now have the choice to gather with students and interact in real time or to prepare course materials for students in advance. While shifting to online learning hasn't been the easiest task, the faculty at UIS plan to persevere as long as COVID-19 is keeping them homebound. I'm Mike Smith.
Well, stick around. There's more to come on Statewide Battling Against the Coronavirus in Nursing Homes. That story is next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. What does the pandemic and the social distancing response mean for farmers' markets and growers? We'll also find out about challenges facing rural hospitals in this time. That and more is on the way. Next, elderly nursing home residents are among the most likely to become seriously ill from the coronavirus. After COVID-19 sickened dozens at a Seattle-area nursing home in March, the federal government told long-term care facilities across the country to block access to visitors and constantly screen residents and staff. Despite preventative measures, we're still seeing nursing home residents test positive. Eli Chin is with St. Louis Public Radio and reports on how understaffed nursing homes are struggling to protect residents from infection.
When St. Louis and Michael Allen heard about how the coronavirus had infected dozens of nursing home residents in Kirkland, Washington, the first person he worried about was his aunt. She lives at Frontier Health and Rehabilitation in St. Charles. Last week, the facility reported that three residents and one employee tested positive for COVID-19. Allen says it's been hard for his father to reach anyone at the facility.
I'm very worried because they're not testing everybody.
Nursing homes have been trying to follow directions from federal and state authorities to protect residents from the virus. But more than 150 nursing homes in the U.S. have residents who tested positive for COVID-19. That includes several in Missouri and Illinois. And many facilities don't have enough staff to keep residents healthy. Chan Hung is the program director at Voice, a group that advocates for long-term care residents in the St. Louis region. He says it's possible nursing home workers are exposing residents to the virus.
These workers, they have their own personal life. And then one worker could work in, you know, 3-5 different nursing homes.
Research shows that well-staffed nursing homes are better at preventing viral infections. But some facilities, like Frontier Health in St. Charles and Life Care Center in St. Louis, were understaffed before the pandemic. Now, nursing homes are losing contract workers who provide physical therapy and mental health services and staff who help keep facilities clean. Bill Bates runs the Missouri chapter of Leading Age, a nonprofit that serves 55 nursing homes and senior living facilities in the state.
We're losing staff to their symptoms, We're losing staff to child care issues, and many staff have lots of leave, and they're kind of scared to go to work, and so they're using their leave.
Isolating residents to protect them from the virus will likely cause some to develop depression. Dr. John Morley is the former medical director of NHC Healthcare Maryland Heights. He says government agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention need to recognize the consequences of social distancing policies.
People in nursing homes can get very isolated very quickly, and there's no way that staff could even go into every room on a regular basis just for them to be able to phone their relatives. So you can't do what CDC wants and keep people healthy.
Chan Hung at Voice says his office gets about 40 calls a day, mainly from family members who worry their relatives aren't taken care of.
You know, we were already not satisfied with the care in the nursing home. Now, you don't let us visit at all. How do we know if they feed mom? How do we know if they change mom's diapers?
A lot of families are using Skype, FaceTime, and other technologies to keep in touch with residents. Cheryl Kenny of the Alzheimer's Association says these methods help some residents, but she says others, like her own father, who is in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, don't understand.
I'm getting calls regularly from my dad who is really not understanding, you know, why is all this going on and why can't you come see me and why can't I get a haircut? And, you know, it's hard for everybody because we weren't prepared for this.
Kenny says it's important for families to understand that restrictions at nursing homes help keep their relatives safe. But the longer the pandemic goes on, the harder it will be for them to stay apart. I'm Eli Chen.
Before and after the Illinois governor issued a stay-at-home order, there was a run on grocery store shelves. Basic food items were hard to come by at some stores. People are still allowed to go to farmers markets and produce stands, but as Dana Cronin with Harvest Public Media reports, farmers worry customers won't return come harvest season.
Patty Marco co-owns and operates Wilsey's Farm Produce in Maple Park, Illinois, about 60 miles west of Chicago. Like most people around the country, she's had a tough couple of weeks.
Oh my, our heads are spinning.
Wilsey's is family-owned and in its fourth generation, and it primarily operates around one crop.
We're kind of known. We hope we are known for our sweet corn.
But they also grow all kinds of fruits and vegetables.
The easiest thing I always say is that we grow A to Z, asparagus to zucchini and everything in between.
While she doesn't have that asparagus or zucchini ready to sell yet, she'd like to start planting it soon. And all this uncertainty is making it really hard to plan.
You kind of plan for the worst and hope for the best.
Marco and her two siblings sell most of the farm's produce out of an old red cattle barn that's been converted into a store. They encourage their customers to visit in person.
The last couple years, if the weather permits, we had even opened up our fields for U-pick items, be it peppers or tomatoes.
But now with COVID-19 spreading around the state and shelter-in-place orders in effect, Marco's wondering whether they'll be able to provide that for their customers this year.
Can I put my tub of vegetables out for a person to pick? Or am I going to have to package everything so there's less handling by the public? I don't know. We don't know.
Leslie Cooperband and her husband run Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery in Champaign, Illinois. They primarily raise goats for cheese and some other dairy products like goat's milk gelato. Between kidding season and getting the creamery up and running, March is usually a pretty crazy month on the farm.
We call it our version of March Madness. It has nothing to do with basketball. It's all about baby goats and milk and cheese.
But this March has been a bit different. Cooperband says they have a few different outlets for their products, including local restaurants, which right now are either limited to carryout orders or shut down entirely. Cooperband says they also rely on local farmers markets to sell their cheese.
The fact that we're not even sure that the farmers market is going to open in May, it is a big thing that's weighing heavily on us.
She says even if the market does open in May, they're expecting attendance to be much lower than usual, with shoppers wary of coming into close contact with other people. Just like Patty Marco at Wilsey's, Cooperband is struggling with the uncertainty.
The reality shifting from hour to hour, day by day, with making it really hard to have any sense of how to plan.
Without the farmers market or restaurants, Cooper Band is trying to come up with alternatives. And she's getting creative.
I'm calling it kind of like a cheese emergency kit where they would be able to order cheese and accompaniments and then either have a drive-by out here at the farm or we may even be able to do some shipping.
She's partnering with other local farmers to include vegetables, meat, and eggs along with the goat cheese. And that's music to Liz Moran Stelk's ears. She's the executive director of the Illinois Stewardship Alliance, which promotes local food producers like Cooper Band and Marco.
These are opportunities for collaboration and collective, you know, people aggregating their products together to get them to people who want it. That's a scale up that we've been waiting for in the local food movement to come. And now it's here because there's this incredible demand.
Stelk says she's been trying to figure out how to get communities to rely on their local food producers. She says this global pandemic could be the catalyst they desperately needed. Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
Hospitals and clinics are limiting knee replacements, cataract surgeries, and other elective or non-emergency procedures. The goal is to conserve medical equipment and reduce the number of people getting care in hospitals as they prepare for a surge in patients sick with COVID-19. The limitations hit Illinois' small rural hospitals particularly hard. Pat Scow is the executive director of the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network, and our Mary Hansen talked with her about these challenges.
What is a critical access hospital?
It's a small rural hospital. They have to be acute care hospital, and they have to be located in a state-designated rural area, a rural county, or a federally designated rural area. It's a Medicare designation, because most of small hospitals serve majority of Medicare patients, and because they're elder patients. The critical access program started in 1999, and there's about 1,365 critical access hospitals nationally. We have 51 in Illinois. And if they agree to the bed size and the average length of stay and having an emergency department and things like that, in turn, the government says, we'll give you cost-based reimbursement plus 1% for Medicare patients. It was really a godsend. I am a firm believer that nearly half or a good portion of our critical access hospitals in Illinois and probably in other states would be closed or have very limited services. It really was a lifeblood.
We heard the governor urging a stop to elective procedures and non-essential surgeries recently, in part to help with this shortage of protective equipment, the gloves and the gowns and the masks. How does that affect critical care or rural hospitals?
They're very much in support of that, and they want to keep people safe. And that was one of the things, is keep people out of the hospital and to make available the protective equipment. However, at the same time, you know, most of their business is outpatient and elective. So about half of their business is gone in a matter of a week or two. So that's been a change breaker. You know, they appreciate it and they're following it and they know the reason for it, but also it's affected financially their situation.
What in particular has the federal government offered to do to help them at this time to sort of get them through?
They're offering immediate loans to the hospitals to help them through the crisis. You know, that's that $100 billion. Many of our hospitals have 500 employees or less. And so as an employer, they may be able to take advantage of the small business loan, which would help them with payroll and things like that. There's some other grant dollars. There may be some funds for them through USDA, some support, loans and immediate support. The other thing that they've done is they've tried, the federal government and the state has done that, is provide some flexibility for telehealth so that if maybe the patient doesn't come into the hospital or to the clinic, that they can use telehealth, and they've expanded that on a short-term basis so that at least we can bill for that and get some revenues in for that. It will help bridge the gap for them. It won't solve all the problems, and they're going to have to be very careful.
During this public health crisis, why are rural hospitals so important? What role might they play in helping urban hospitals?
First of all, our hospitals, they serve a catchment area, about 20 to 25,000 rural residents around them. They are the first line. You know, they're the support system for the emergency medical services in their communities and so forth. And so they provide, and they also provide all the primary care. The other component to that is in a situation like this where we have crises, a surge, they can take some of those patients that maybe a larger facility can't take anymore. And so they can have some sharing of patients. And that's the valuable part. It's the primary care, the emergency department, it's a support system for that rural community, and it's a partner to these larger facilities.
Pat Scow is executive director of the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network. She talked with Mary Hansen. It's been another week in Illinois with bars closed and dine-in restaurants off limits. Restaurants are in limbo as they scramble to get by on just takeout and curbside delivery orders. Olivia Mitchell has more on how some are coping.
Renetta Frazier serves 40 children a day through the drive-up window at her restaurant, Great House Barbecue.
Hello, beautifuls. How many lunches?
Three. I got you.
Due to overlapping problems related to COVID-19, she was faced with the difficult decision to temporarily close the restaurant. Frazier and her family opened Gray House just 5 months ago, which hasn't given them enough time to establish a safety net. She is worried about how long the stay-at-home order will last.
If it extends and they have not completed the work for grants that they are telling us would be available, our restaurant would definitely be in trouble.
Frazier says she's behind on bills and she wants to help her employees who don't qualify for unemployment. Frazier isn't the only one waiting for help from the government. Mark Fornash, owner of Cafe Moxo, located in downtown Springfield, reports a significantly low employee retention rate.
You know, we have had to lay off 15 employees.
How many employees do you have right now?
Three.
Fornash says the job is labor intensive and he needs his employees back.
We don't have the opportunity to work from home. We don't have the opportunity to automate anything. We still do everything by scratch and by hand.
Also located downtown Springfield is Arlington's restaurant. Last week, 12 events were canceled, which brings the total to 52. Owner Eben Moore says he's losing money, but he is using the extra time wisely.
We get the bonus of being able to do some remodeling and spring cleaning kind of thing. We're really, really hoping to drum up enough business, even if we could just break even.
Some restaurant owners are taking innovative approaches to cope with the new normal. Brent Swearer, owner of Ingrain Brewery, opened an online market and joined his neighbor, Spring Hill Suites Hotel, in a deal that allows customers to order from Ingrain and then rent a room at a reduced price. But Swearer still finds himself in a tough position.
Me as the small business owner, I'm basically busting my butt just so I can lose money every day.
Swearer says he believes the government will support small businesses, but like all the other owners, he questions how quickly bureaucrats will approve loans and distribute money. Sam Toya, president of the Illinois Restaurant Association, says loans could hit bank accounts of eligible business owners as early as next week. This raises the question, who's eligible?
You have to be a small business that lost 25% or more of your business, and you have 500 or less employees per entity.
The money comes from the Payment Protection Program, part of the new $2 trillion federal stimulus package. It provides guaranteed loans for small businesses and nonprofits through the COVID-19 emergency. The goal is to keep workers with their company and off unemployment.
They can get their annual average monthly payroll times 2.5 to pay their team members' payroll, to pay their mortgage or rent, and or their utilities.
The measure should assist small businesses for the next 8 to 10 weeks. There are over 800 participating banks that will distribute the loans. After recipients verify they use the money to pay bills and employees, the loan turns into a grant and will be forgiven. Even with the help, there will be long-term consequences, says Fornash, who runs Cafe Moxo.
We're going to have to come back slowly and surely because you never know what's going to happen around the corner. So we're really going to have to get our feet back off the ice before I start to take any risks or try to grow my business.
If you are involved in the restaurant or hospitality business and need guidance, resources are available at IllinoisRestaurants.org. I'm Olivia Mitchell.
There's more of Statewide ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, with the economic hit we've seen due to COVID-19, it appears more people may turn to sex work for income. We'll hear more about that. That story's on the way. Many people are being told to work from home, but manufacturing in the state of Illinois is still up and running, in many cases making new products that are needed to meet the health and safety demands during the crisis. Two business organizations, the Illinois Manufacturers Association and the Illinois Biotechnology Innovation Organization, or iBio, have partnered to scale up production of medical equipment and other needed items. And I talk with the Manufacturers Association president, Mark Densler. Mark, tell us about the partnership to scale up production as part of the fight against the coronavirus. What's happening among Illinois manufacturers?
Well, I was honored to be asked by Governor Pritzker, along with John Conrad from iBio, to co-chair the Essential Equipment Task Force designed to procure new essential equipment. So things like ventilators and masks and swabs to make sure that Illinois hospitals and healthcare facilities have enough equipment to treat people impacted by the COVID-19 virus. We are working with manufacturers who I'm really proud are stepping up every day to increase production, retool their facilities to produce this much needed medical equipment and devices. And so, again, manufacturers have really stepped up. We've seen Abbott recently announced a new test that you can get results in minutes, and companies like Diageo, who are switching their lines from vodka, for example, to make hand sanitizer. We have companies that are going from making clothing to making N95 masks. And so really, it's been an amazing outpouring of support by the manufacturing community who are stepping up to meet this challenge.
And not only does that help the efforts that's needed, the public safety effort, but also I'm guessing it would also help the manufacturers and employees in many cases stay on the job.
You know, it does. And the first and foremost is that manufacturers are concerned about the safety of their employees and their communities. So it's important to note as well, Sean, that manufacturers are taking steps such as increased sanitation or mandatory sanitation breaks, checking temperatures of employees who may be coming into a facility. In some cases, splitting shifts. So if they have 100 employees on one shift, they might be going to two shifts of 50 and making sure that there's spacing between the employees. So they're doing everything they can, first and foremost, to fight the virus and make sure that their facility is not impacted by it. But then again, manufacturers who are currently making this medical equipment, they're ramping up production and they're working 24/7. We are appreciative of the governor and several of his agencies that have taken steps to make it a little bit easier. A couple examples, the Department of Transportation now allows overweight trucks to deliver goods so we can transport products quicker and more efficiently. The Department of Labor, there's a law that says employees cannot work 7 consecutive days unless there's an application. Employees can now volunteer to work that 7th day a week. Manufacturing employees, just 592,000 men and women on factory floors today, and a lot of them want to volunteer to work because they know that the products they're making are helping save lives.
Now, not all manufacturers, I think, can probably retool the way we're talking about. So are you seeing a lot of manufacturing sites that are being closed because of the current situation?
There's a small handful of manufacturing sites that are closing, but what we're really seeing, Sean, is this huge outpouring of support of companies that really are changing their production. For example, we have injection molders that maybe have never made anything for the medical sector before, and they're now making parts for ventilators, or they're making face shields, you know, and things like that. And again, a lot of our alcohol companies are now making hand sanitizer. We have companies that are making partitions and beds, and supplies for those. And so it really is kind of an all hands on deck, almost a war room, where manufacturers are shifting production to meet the state and the nation's demand.
Is there some concern, Mark, going forward that when they return to regular production, that the economy won't be doing quite as well and people may not be able to buy the products that had been made before, or at least not buy them in the same amount? Is there some growing concern out there among manufacturers about what the future may bring?
I think there's concern by everyone about what the global economy and the nation's economy are going to look like. This is unprecedented in our nation's history. We've never seen this many unemployment insurance claims. five times the previous record in 1982 and literally hitting within a week or two. So we're not sure what the future holds. What I can tell you is that manufacturers are part of the solution. We have companies, again, food companies, making sure that we have a safe and a good supply of food on the grocery store shelves. That's one thing that people don't have to worry about. Folks don't have to hoard products because our manufacturers are making sure that we have food, and our chemical manufacturers making sure we have sanitizer. Certainly coming out of this, it's going to be interesting to see what demand is, for example, for auto manufacturers and in their supply chain. And certainly the airline industry is struggling with this. And, you know, we have Boeing and a large presence of aerospace manufacturing in Illinois. And so it's going to be a challenge for some of those sectors going forward. And we hope that the this turns around sooner than what may be expected. But I'm sure that manufacturers will continue leading the way forward.
For years, there have been a lot of calls to increase manufacturing or return manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. From other countries where a lot of them have moved in the recent decades. Once this is over, are you expecting to see maybe some type of change, some type of return to the glory days, I guess you might say, for manufacturing? There might be more of those jobs moving back home to not only the U.S., but right here in Illinois?
That's a great question, and I really hope that our policymakers understand the impact of their regulations and laws on manufacturers, particularly the governor and members of the Illinois General Assembly. Just 2 months ago, Sean, we saw members of the General Assembly putting forth legislation that would negatively impact the refineries and the chemical companies and significantly increase their cost. And right now, the chemical companies are stepping forward like never before in history, making sanitizer and cleaner and products. I really hope that our policymakers understand the critical role of manufacturing, that we need more manufacturing jobs in Illinois. These are good, high-paying, middle-class jobs, and we need to attract manufacturers back to the United States and Illinois instead of imposing policies that make them look elsewhere.
Well, let's end on a positive note and something maybe a little bit lighter. In the past month or so, we've seen the NCAA Final Four championships. Those were canceled, but you had your own contest. It was called Maker's Madness, and that was an online voting method of which you were kind of setting up brackets among different manufacturers in the state and the products they make, and you finally came up with a winner. Can you tell us about that?
We did, Sean, and this was a fun contest we kicked off about 2 months ago. We had 260 unique products that were entered in the contest to be named the coolest thing made in Illinois. And through four rounds of voting, we narrowed that down to the Sweet 16, Elite 8, Final Four. And we announced the winner this week, the Caterpillar 797F large mining truck, actually made in my hometown of Decatur. But we had 300,000 votes over the last couple of weeks in this contest. And it was a great way to really showcase great manufactured products in Illinois and the great careers that go along with those. It was an interesting Final Four. We had the Caterpillar mining truck. We had Bloomington Beer Nuts in their bar mix, Wall Clipper and Sterling. And then the fourth was a neat product called Functional Hand, made by a couple of ladies in Elmhurst and then actually produced at the Maker's Lab at U of I, that helps children and adults that can't properly grip a pencil or a fork because they might have like cerebral palsy or MS. And so four really neat products, the largest of the large to the smallest of the small. And we were heartened again, 300,000 people voted and the Caterpillar mining truck won this year. We're going to have an annual event and we think it'll be bigger and better next year.
That's Mark Densler. He's the president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Mark, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Sean. Have a great day.
This is Statewide. Desperate times can result in some desperate measures, and some who suddenly have no job are turning to sex work to pay bills. Dana Vollmer with member station WCBU in Peoria reported on this topic, and I had a chance to talk with her about it. Dana, you spoke with an organization that keeps an eye on this, and what did you learn about what's going on right now?
Jolt Harm Reduction is an organization we have here that kind of keeps an eye on things like sex workers and also drug use, with the knowledge that these things are going to happen regardless of whether or not we want them to. And the best thing to do is to keep people safe. So part of their outreach with sex workers is to do an online survey. Loosely, it's based in central Illinois. For the most part, the folks that they're dealing with are based here around Peoria. They don't keep rigid numbers, but one of the things that they were seeing was new faces coming onto these surveys that they had never encountered before. So these are people that are looking to meet clients. And so they usually are kind of familiar with the players, but all of a sudden we're seeing more and more new faces at the same time as things like bars and clubs were closing.
So it could be someone that maybe was a dancer at a club, for example. It could be somebody who was a waitress or bartender at a club that relied on a lot of tipped income, and those people now are not seeing that income.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was one of the examples that they used, was somebody that dances for a living. That, you know, dancers are not always people who engage in sex work. Sometimes they are just performers, but during this time, they are seeing some people who dance now pursuing this, as well as people from other tip-based kind of hospitality, customer service, and entertainment positions. So as you mentioned, it could be a bartender, it could be a server at a restaurant. Again, tip-based, they tend to be contract employees and not have eligibility for things like unemployment insurance. So this is a really quick way to make money.
And some people might be shocked to hear some of this, but at the same time, these are people who, as you mentioned, they may not feel they have other options right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jolt's position is that many, but not all people who are involved in sex work are doing it out of necessity. Most of them are kind of living day to day, not even week to week. They don't have a lot in savings, not inherently because they're bad with money, but just because of the nature of that trade being fairly inconsistent, and also with all the other expenses that they have, it tends to be a pretty vulnerable population financially.
There was, if you're going to say there's some bright spot in all of this, they also, though, pointed out that not everybody is doing, you know, personal contact when it comes to sex work. Some of that is virtual, on the web type of work. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So one of the things that they're seeing, as you're saying, is people meeting clients digitally instead of face-to-face. So that can involve things like camming, which is, you know, a video camera. Either it could just be the camera on your laptop screen, where you're engaging with someone one-on-one or in a group chat and performing for them that way. There's also kind of direct sale of photos and videos. That's a fairly common way for people to make money digitally. And sometimes it's also just chat rooms. So nothing that you're inherently trading, but the conversation that you're having with someone.
And Dana, do they feel as though this will possibly subside once the crisis with coronavirus is over, once that people may have jobs to go back to, if they do?
You know, it's too soon to tell. Things like camming and online sex work can be very lucrative. So, you know, it's possible that someone that has never done this before can see that money and, you know, if they're comfortable with that work, continue to do it in their own free time. It's very little overhead and also kind of on your own schedule. So there's a chance that some folks may find that this is a viable way for them to continue to bring income. But I would imagine that, again, as we're talking about potentially dancers and clubs, if that club were to reopen, they could go back. And I would imagine the same would be true of bars and restaurants, but we're just not sure yet.
Dana Vollmer is a reporter with WCBU in Peoria. Read more of her story on what appears to be an increase in sex workers because of the current economic situation. We have a link at our website at statewideshow.com. That wraps up Statewide for this week. Join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. And again, our website, statewideshow.com. All of our episodes can be found there. I'm Sean Crawford. Stay safe and stay home if possible. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.